All right, here we go. We are continuing our newspaper coverage on this Wednesday. It's the 8th of April, 2026. With the Boston Globe, we say hello to Karen and Pamela.
Well, happy Wednesday, listeners. This is Karen.
And this is Pamela.
Welcoming all of you to today's reading of the Boston Globe. And let's start with the lead story on today's front page from the Associated Press out of Tehran. Trump backs off, okay, ceasefire. Had threatened whole civilization will die with strikes. Iran says it will allow passage through strait for 2 weeks. President Trump pulled back on his threats to launch devastating strikes on Iran late Tuesday, swerving to de-escalate the war less than 2 hours before the deadline he set for Tehran to capitulate to a deal. Trump said he was holding off on his threatened attacks on Iranian bridges and power plants as the United States and Iran agreed to a 2-week ceasefire that includes the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz. Iran's Supreme National Security Council said that it has accepted the ceasefire and that it would negotiate with the United States in Islamabad beginning Friday. Neither Iran nor the United States said when the ceasefire would begin, and attacks took place in Israel, Iran, and across the Gulf region early Wednesday. Israel has also agreed to the ceasefire, according to a White House official who was not authorized to comment publicly and spoke on condition of anonymity. The ceasefire calls for Israel and Hezbollah to halt fighting in Lebanon, according to the Prime Minister of Pakistan, which has been mediating talks. In the version of its 10-point plan released in Farsi, Iran included the phrase acceptance of enrichment for its nuclear program. But for reasons that remain unclear, that phrase was missing in English versions shared by Iranian diplomats to journalists. Trump initially had said Iran proposed a workable 10-point plan that could help end the war launched by the United States and Israel in February. But he later called it fraudulent, without elaborating. Trump has said ending Iran's nuclear program entirely was a key point of the war. Pro-government demonstrators in the streets of Iran's capital screamed, "Death to America, death to Israel, death to compromisers," after the ceasefire announcement Wednesday morning. They also burned American and Israeli flags in the street. It shows the ongoing anger from hardliners who had been preparing for what many assumed would be an apocalyptic battle with the United States. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said passage through the strait would be allowed under Iranian military management. It wasn't immediately clear whether that meant Iran would completely loosen its chokehold on the waterway. The plan allows for both Iran and Oman to charge fees on ships transiting through the strait, according to a regional official who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss negotiations they were directly involved in. The official said Iran would use the money it raised for reconstruction. In addition to control of the strait, Iran's demands for ending the war include withdrawal of U.S. combat forces from the region, the lifting of sanctions, and the release of its frozen assets. Since the war began, Trump has repeatedly backed off deadlines just before they expire. In doing so again Tuesday, Trump said in a social media post he had come to the decision based on conversations with Pakistan Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif and General Asim Munir, Pakistan's powerful army chief. Sharif, in a post on X hours earlier, urged Trump to extend his deadline by 2 weeks to allow diplomacy to advance. He used the same post to ask Iran to open the strait for 2 weeks. Almost all of the various points of past contention have been agreed to between the United States and Iran, but a 2-week period will allow the agreement to be finalized and consummated, Trump said. There are concerns in Israel about the agreement, according to a person familiar with the situation. The person said Israel would like to achieve more. Iran's stockpile of highly enriched uranium is still buried at enrichment sites. The program had been one of the main issues cited by both Israel and the United States in launching the war. A whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again, if a deal isn't reached, Trump said in an online post Tuesday morning. But he also seemed to keep open the possibility of an off-ramp, saying that maybe something revolutionarily wonderful can happen. Trump's expansive threat did not seem to account for potential harm to civilians, prompting Democrats in Congress, some United Nations officials, and scholars in military law to say such strikes would violate international law. Tehran's representative at the UN, Amir Sayed Iravani, said that the threats constitute incitement to war crimes and potentially genocide, and that Iran would take immediate and proportionate reciprocal measures if Trump launches devastating strikes. The United States and Israel have battered Iran with attacks targeting its military capabilities, leadership, and nuclear program. Iran has responded with a stream of strikes on Israel and Gulf Arab neighbors, causing regional chaos and outsized economic and political shock. Late Tuesday, Pakistan's prime minister urged Trump to extend his deadline by 2 weeks to allow diplomacy to advance. In a post on X, Shabazz Sharif, whose country has been leading negotiations, also asked Iran to open up for 2 weeks the Strait of Hormuz. China, which is Tehran's biggest trade partner, encouraged the Iranians to find a way to a ceasefire as talks progressed, according to two officials who were not authorized to comment publicly. Before the deadline, airstrikes hit two bridges and a train station, and the United States hit military infrastructure on Karg Island, a key hub for Iranian oil production. Pamela?
Thanks, Karen. A touching farewell to a gentle presence. Last of steers at Brookline Farm mourned. Curtis and Willard, a pair of Highland steers, were an unlikely sight. Two looming, shaggy sentinels roaming the pastures along Brookline's Allendale Road. Since 2008, the Vermont transplants lived at historic urban garden center Allendale Farm and had many friends in those who visited, especially children. Willard died about a year ago under the weight of years in his own massive body, and in January, so went his brother Curtis. On Saturday, about 75 mourners, many of them very young, gathered to celebrate Curtis with a proper Scottish send-off. As bagpipes wound through the crisp April air, it felt like many a Boston funeral. And though the deceased was bovine, the grief shared around the bonfire was quite human. Mourners recalled the contradiction between Curtis's heft and horns and his sleepy, gentle nature. He was beloved by the smallest children who enjoyed feeding him apples and fearlessly petting his nose. As deaths can mark the passage of time as much as the memory of the deceased, the memorial felt like the end of an era for many families who saw Allendale steers as a centerpiece of farm visits. Younger, regular visitors had never known the farm without Curtis and Willard. Sighs and sniffles could be heard, while Jack McLean, a bagpiper for 57 years, performed in tartan by the bonny banks of Allendale's Frog Pond. Listening to tributes, it would be easy to mistake the departed for a quiet and humble chap about the village, were it not for the specifically animal reminders. He'd happily eat right out of your hand with his big black tongue and his blunt ivory teeth, said Farm General Manager Helen Glotzer, who led memorial. He loved to be brushed, and when you stopped, he would thump his horns against his flank to tell you to keep going. He loved fresh hay, warm sunlight, and cool mud. He had a really good life on the farm, and he was a good, good boy. Curtis and Willard had surprised the neighborhood from the start when they were brought there 18 years ago by former Allendale farm manager John Lee from his family farm. They stood shoulder high to an 8-year-old, their horns still tiny nubs. What are these mythical creatures living in the woods? Farm officer manager Rachel Nagan of Mattapan remembers wondering when she first noticed them from the road before joining the staff. They became a community fixture in a very short order, recalled Lee of Carlisle. Scotch Highland cattle are just really lovely cattle, very docile, very sociable, and these two were just terrific. As you can see, people loved them. Amy Guizada of Brookline said the steers amazed visiting friends. They'd be like, I just saw these two steer out of the blue, she said, and it was really special to have it in a place that you wouldn't normally expect it. They were just part of the community. Visiting the animals has been a big part of how we build empathy in our classrooms, so we really miss them, said Katie Sawatsky, a teacher at Apple Orchard School, a preschool located at Allendale Farm. Earlier in their relationship, Kimberly Ritter of Brookline gave her wife a portrait of a Highland steer, her favorite animal. The artwork became a treasured focal point in their home. When they moved to Brookline, they met Curtis and Willard. Sometimes that happens with animals, said Ritter, who attended the memorial with her daughter. They seem to appear in places over and over again for you in your life. Was Curtis lonely after Willard died? It's hard to say. Some tried, anyway. Glotzer recalled last spring's memorial for Willard, where Curtis soaked up love, apples, and oats from attendees. When McLean began to play the closing bagpipe tune, Curtis emerged from the barn and appeared to stand at attention. Willard, said Natkin, could be a bit of a bully, hogging the feed. After his death, Curtis initially seemed to enjoy his newfound freedom, and he had lots of company. When Willard died last year, the children took it upon themselves to make sure that Curtis was never lonely, said Sherry Landry, an Apple Orchard School teacher. Kids as young as two would sit beside the barn and sing The Wheels on the Bus to him. Nagin said in addition to his human friends, he had animal attendants. After Willard died, ducks seemed to visit more. Turtles stopped in, and so did herons. He wasn't alone, said Nagin. He definitely had his own community, but I definitely think he missed his brother at some point and made peace with it. Curtis grew sluggish, a sign of loneliness, Nagin said, and his keepers, tasked with translating his expressions into caretaking strategy, began to realize his time was coming. A fall hastened his decline, and the night of January 27th, after a winter storm dumped more than a foot of snow in Boston, his closest wards covered his 2,000-pound body in blankets and saw him through the end. For some of the youngest guests, it was their first time attending a memorial and a chance for parents to open up an early conversation about loss and grief. Charlie Gamwell, 9, sat with her father, Greg Gamwell, holding a bouquet of daffodils and a Snoopy stuffed animal she had brought in honor of Curtis. The two have been visiting the farm together since she was a baby and loved to share carrots and pats with Curtis after purchasing vegetables. When Greg learned of the recent death, he rushed home from work to share the news with his three children, who all love Curtis. I'm really happy that everybody showed up and that Curtis will have a good memory, said Charlie. What was she thinking about while she gathered flowers for Curtis? We were thinking that Curtis is a great person, he began. A great animal, interjected Greg. A great animal, she said. And we're really sad that he died, but we will always have his memory. Greg said the family talked about how, recently, they noticed that Curtis had seemed quieter, and perhaps he had been lonely. We all decided it was very important to be here, said Gamwell. We skipped our son's soccer game for this. We just felt this is more important. And this is your first experience with death, an animal that's close to you, he said, acknowledging Charlie. At the close of the memorial, the bagpipes rose again and the crowd dispersed. Only the sound of wind and the occasional passing car remained down by the empty barn and pasture, whose hayfield gates now sit open for the first time in 18 years. While Curtis and Willard have become a part of the farm's history, Glotzer has some good news. Following a calving session, a new pair of steers will arrive next year.
Yeah. Oh, what a sweet story. Rest in peace, Curtis and Willard. And now moving on to another front page story, hunger at new heights in Massachusetts. Rising costs are putting more families at risk. And this is a Globe staff article. As prices continue to climb on everything from gas to energy to groceries, a record 40% of Massachusetts households are now reporting food insecurity, according to a new study from the Greater Boston Food Bank and Mass General Brigham. The report found that 1.12 million households didn't have reliable access to food last year, a rate that's up from 37% in 2024, and more than double pre-pandemic levels. It's been a very difficult year for people across the Commonwealth, said Catherine D'Amato, president and chief executive of the Greater Boston Food Bank, which partners with 600 agencies across 190 towns in New England and serves 600,000 people each month. D'Amato cited a cascade of factors contributing to this most recent uptick: persistent inflation, rising housing costs, and a retraction of federal programs that support needy families, all of which have a compounding effect. The economy is such that they don't have enough to make ends meet, she said. It's a frightening thing. The hunger study, which launched in 2020 in response to the pandemic, has served as a bellwether in the state over the past 6 years, said Dr. Lauren Fichtner, a pediatrician at MGB and the senior health and research advisor at the food bank. The 30 members of the Health and Research Council who produced the report represent some of the brightest minds in food insecurity research in the state and in the country, she said. And the more than 300-question online survey polled 18,000 respondents from across the state over the past 6 years, roughly 3,000 per year, measuring metrics including food access, dietary quality changes, financial strain, and discrimination. And the work is all the more important now after the USDA announced it would end its redundant food insecurity study last fall after over 30 years, Fichtner said. Increasingly, other states have been looking to Massachusetts for guidance as they roll out their own hunger policies. The data really matters, Fichtner said. Among the report's most significant findings is that Hispanic households have consistently experienced the highest rates of food insecurity during the past 6 years, with levels reaching 63% in 2025. Black households, 51%, and LGBTQ plus households, 58%, continue to experience outsized levels of food insecurity as well. Additionally, a record 56% of food insecure households turned to community-based food programs to help meet their needs in 2025, and 75% of families receiving help through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, reported that they still needed additional support to keep food on the table. Nationally, food prices have climbed by nearly 30% since March 2020, according to the Consumer Price Index. And, according to MIT's Living Wage Calculator, a family of four, two working adults with two children, living in Suffolk County, now needs an annual income of $184,000 per year. The state of hunger in Massachusetts has moved from emergency to normalcy, D'Amato said, with the divide between the state's haves and have-nots becoming more extreme. She said that many of today's pantry guests do have resources, but they just don't have enough. You might have a job, you might have two, you might own your own home, you might still be going to a food pantry, she said. You might have been a laid-off worker in a shutdown. You might have been a TSA worker. Now, we have had all of those things. The 2025 report reflects a scale back in SNAP benefits due to changes in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, D'Amato said. But as the law's measures, which tightened eligibility and created work requirements, continue to be rolled out, more than 150,000 Massachusetts residents are seeing reduced or canceled benefits. The report also notes that in 2025, Massachusetts food banks experienced $3.4 million in federal funding cuts from the USDA's Emergency Food Assistance Program, and it estimates that the state will require an additional $3.3 billion a year in funding to solve food security statewide. D'Amato said that increasing state-level funding through the Massachusetts Emergency Food Assistance Program to $58 million would be one way to help meet the need. This report highlights what I hear every day. The high cost of living is causing families to choose between paying for rent or childcare or food, Representative Jim McGovern said. We know that the federal changes to SNAP and Medicaid will only make this affordability crisis worse. We should be shoring up our public investments, not walking away from our hungry neighbors. Pamela?
Euphoria lifts off with Artemis mission. Astrophiles and NASA awash with moon joy. During their historic lunar flyby Monday, the astronauts of the NASA mission Artemis II were working hard to identify and photograph features on the far side of the moon. Their account went beyond the plain and technical language often associated with science. Instead, they were full of wonder, excitement, and reflection. "I just had an overwhelming sense of being moved by looking at the moon," Christina Koch, a mission specialist aboard the spacecraft, which the astronauts named Integrity, reported to Mission Control. "The moon really is in its own unique body in the universe," Koch, a NASA astronaut, added. "It's not just a poster in the sky that goes by. It's a real place." Science is often viewed as colorless and objective, to be conducted with little emotion or expression. But as the Artemis II crew members painted lunar hills, valleys, and plains in the minds of listeners back home, they provide a model for a poignant approach to scientific inquiry. The awe emerged over the weekend as they approached the moon. Reid Wiseman of NASA, the mission's commander, eagerly noted impact craters in a swirl on the lunar surface. "It's just everything from the training, but in three dimensions, and absolutely unbelievable," he said. "This is incredible." Jackie Mahaffey, a NASA officer in Mission Control, laughed in response. "Copy, moon joy," she said. As the lunar surface grew closer, that moon joy intensified. Jeremy Hansen, a mission specialist with Canadian Space Agency, described the view from the spacecraft as mind-blowing. Victor Glover, the pilot, was particularly enthralled by the magic of the moon's terminator line, which separates its sunlight side from the part shrouded in darkness. He noted islands of light and valleys of black holes along the divider. "You'd fall straight to the center of the moon if you stepped in some of those," he said. Glover was also struck by how sharp the features of the moon looked through his camera lens. "It was hard to speak," he told Mission Control during the flyby. In between more technical descriptions of the moon, he described where his imagination had gone. "I was walking around down there on the surface, climbing and off-roading on that amazing terrain," he said. Down in Houston, Mission Control cheered. "We just all went on that moonwalk with you," said Kelsey Young, a lunar expert who was leading the scientific part of the Artemis II mission. During a news conference Saturday, Young explained that the astronauts underwent extensive training to learn how to give scientific descriptions of the moon, studying everything from flashcards in class to the moon-like terrain of Iceland. The sentiment in their responses, however, felt unrehearsed, and rather than discourage the emotion, Young seemed to feel it with them. That expressiveness came to a height while the crew watched a solar eclipse from space during the final part of their lunar flyby. The sun slipped behind the moon, inducing a halo of light around the lunar rim, while its face shone faintly, lit by the glow from Earth. "After all the amazing sights that we saw earlier, we just went sci-fi," Glover said. "You can actually see a majority of the moon. It's the strangest looking thing that you can see so much on the surface." The crew described a field of stars surrounding a darkened moon and identified Mars from its reddish hue, as well as an orangey Saturn. Earth also glimmered bright. Wiseman and Hansen reported flashes of light on the lunar surface, meteor strikes in real time, which made Young rise from her seat. As the sun emerged on the other side of the moon, the astronauts likened the growing spot of light on the lunar horizon to a flame and the wispy streams of its outer atmosphere to baby hair. After a while, words just couldn't suffice. "No matter how long we look at this, our brains are not processing," said Wiseman, who jokingly requested that Mission Control send him a list of new words to expand his vocabulary. "There are no adjectives," he said. "I'm going to need to invent new ones. There's absolutely no words to describe what we're looking at out this window." Kara?
Oh, sounds great. And from today's Metro section, Clancy team asks judge to reconsider splitting trial. Lindsay Clancy would admit to killing her three children if a judge reverses course and agrees to split her upcoming murder trial into two phases, her lawyer said in court papers. In a filing submitted in Plymouth Superior Court, defense attorney Kevin Reddington asked Judge William F. Sullivan to reconsider his ruling denying a defense motion to split the trial into a guilt phase followed by a criminal responsibility phase. Clancy is willing to stipulate formally in writing to her involvement in the underlying conduct resulting in the death of the three young children, Reddington wrote last week in court papers. This is not a dramatic change in strategy, as Reddington has long said his client intends to assert a defense of a lack of criminal responsibility, commonly known as the insanity defense. But the continued push to divide the trial is an unusual step that underscores the tensions in a murder case that raise questions of mental health and postpartum care. Prosecutors from the Plymouth District Attorney's Office continue to oppose splitting the trial. They wrote they will not agree to any offer from Clancy to stipulate to the deaths. The move by Clancy's lawyer is likely an effort to avoid testimony about the horrific killings, said Christina Miller, a Suffolk law professor and former prosecutor. If the prosecution were to agree to a stipulation, the judge would read agreed-upon facts to the jury, and then the trial would move on, potentially skipping testimony from first responders or other witnesses to the deaths of Clancy's three young children. The reading, Miller said, likely would be, quote, colder and more clinical than testimony from first responders or other witnesses about the deaths of Clancy's three young children. Reddington has asserted Clancy was suffering from postpartum depression at the time of the killings and had been prescribed 13 different medications used to treat mood disorders, psychosis, and anxiety. Should Clancy be acquitted under the insanity defense, she wouldn't go free, but rather would be sent to a state psychiatric facility where she'd come up for periodic review to determine whether she could safely live in the community. The defendant understands that the government has a right to prove its case, but where there is an agreement for a stipulation that she killed her children, the defendant submits that it is elevating form over substance to require a full-blown trial on the issue of culpability as opposed to criminal responsibility, Reddington wrote. The government said in a reply filing it will not agree to any stipulations of fact regarding the violent and painful murders of Cora Clancy, Dawson Clancy, or Callan Clancy, choosing to present evidence to a jury of their mother's guilt rather than rely on her on an admission from her. The court agreed with the Commonwealth that evidence of the defendant's extreme atrocity or cruelty, elements to prove first-degree murder, could be properly considered on the issue of criminal responsibility in a single trial rather than a split proceeding, prosecutors wrote. Reddington said in a follow-up filing that the reference to an agreement to stipulate to the killings was a nod to the defense agreeing internally to offer up the admission, not an agreement struck with prosecutors. Clancy, 35, has pleaded not guilty to three counts each of murder and strangulation or suffocation for allegedly killing her children, Cora, 5, Dawson, 3, and Callan, 8 months, with exercise bans on January 24, 2023, after sending her husband out to get takeout for the family. Authorities say she cut her wrists and neck after allegedly killing her children and leapt from a second-story window in a failed attempt to end her own life. She's now paralyzed from the waist down and remains held at Tewksbury Hospital, where she continues to receive treatment. Sullivan, late last month, denied the initial defense motion to split the trial into two phases, finding the question of her guilt needn't be separated from the question of criminal responsibility. Indeed, he wrote, two trials would have significant redundant evidence. These are overlapping issues that do not require bifurcation, Sullivan wrote. Pamela?
And also from the Metro section, Somerville Church wins homeless shelter case. When members of a church near Davis Square built a homeless shelter in their basement, they said they did it because their faith called them to help the poor. This week, a state judge agreed. A ruling in land court on Monday found that the congregation at the First Church Somerville was within its rights to convert a large space inside its building into a 26-bed adult shelter, even though local zoning clearly forbids it. The case hinged on whether the shelter complied with the Dover Amendment, which can allow faith-based organizations to skirt zoning rules when they build for religious purposes. Judge Diane R. Rubin said in a 53-page ruling that the church had shown its decision-making process was grounded in spiritual reflection, and that it was guided by robust scriptural support for housing the unsheltered and caring for strangers in both the Old and New Testament. Barring an appeal, it clears the way for the church to open a new facility to house homeless adults later this year, over the objections of some neighbors, at a time when the city is searching for a way to solve both housing and quality of life issues in a neighborhood where visible homelessness and drug use has been on the rise. We're really glad this part of the journey is over, the Reverend Jen Macy, the church lead pastor, said in an interview Tuesday. We believe housing our unhoused neighbors and helping with the problems that Somerville is having with housing insecurity is a mandate of our faith. We are excited and ready to be good neighbors to all, including the folks we've had conflict with over the past 2 years. Neighbors who opposed the shelter sued in 2024, saying the city was wrong to grant the church a building permit, and accused the congregation of abusing state law to put a shelter on a residential street where it doesn't belong. Along the way, they had suggested the church was simply trying to balance its books by having a rent-paying nonprofit set up in their building. They also said families had felt sidelined, even though they had legitimate concerns about how the shelter would run and its low-barrier policy, which means it would not turn away people with drug problems or histories of violent and sexual crimes. The case went to trial last year. The neighbors in a statement on Tuesday said they were disappointed by the ruling, but said they were ready to work with church leadership moving forward. From the day the shelter was announced, neighbors have sought open dialogue with the church and the Somerville Homeless Coalition to explore how to balance their mission with the reasonable safety and quality of life concerns of the community. We hope that such a dialogue may now prove fruitful in the wake of this ruling, the neighbors said in a statement. We remain open to the proposed shelter and will continue to pursue a positive outcome for all parties. We hope this can be achieved through discussion rather than continued litigation. The plaintiffs in the case were neighbors Jane Becker and Marion Chu. Their lawyer, Michael S. Rabi, said they hadn't decided whether to appeal. We are weighing our options, he said. The decision clears a path for the church and its partner, the Somerville Homeless Coalition, to open the shelter later this year. Leadership said it may take several weeks of preparations, and they would give neighbors 30 days' notice before officially opening the doors. It has room for 26 people to stay overnight, 10 more at the coalition's current location at another church down the street. The coalition plans to close the old one, which dates back to the 1980s and has fallen into disrepair. The church has already renovated the new space and has the necessary permitting from the city to open when it's ready. It would be the city's first fully handicap-accessible shelter. For his part, Coalition Director Michael Libby said he was eager to get the new shelter up and running at a time when the population of unhoused people gathering nearby has been increasing. We are consistently working with the community and the city to be able to do what we can to address the issue, Libby said. One of the ways we can do that is to help people off the streets and out of the parks and invite them inside. The decision comes as warmer months near and as Somerville prepares for an unexpected influx of people spending days and nights in the square, which has been a source of conflict here. It will be the first under new Mayor Jake Wilson, who in the past expressed support for the church's shelter plans and also said that humanely addressing violence and open drug use in the area would be a priority of his administration. We're in the middle of a regional shortage of overnight shelter beds, and that has real consequences for people's safety and dignity. So this is a meaningful step forward for Somerville and for the broader effort to make sure people have a safe place to sleep indoors, Wilson said in a statement, adding, I'm committed to working with the First Church, the Somerville Homeless Coalition, and the neighborhood residents to make sure we're creating a space that both serves people in need and fits well within the community. Kara?
Thanks, Pamela. And now let's take a look at sports with some good news out of Fenway. Sox stop skid with win over Brewers. Crochet tops Mizorowski in duel of stellar starters. On a frozen night at Fenway Park, the sizzling fastballs of Milwaukee right-hander Jacob Mizorowski presented what seemed like an insurmountable challenge early in the game as he struck out batter after batter. That's elite, elite stuff, manager Alex Cora said. But it was Red Sox ace Garrett Crochet who pitched deeper into the game and ultimately a little bit better in a 3-2 victory before an announced crowd of 33,193. Three hits were enough for the desperate Sox as Crochet and three relievers held the Brewers to five singles. Aroldis Chapman got the final three outs for his third save. It was 35 degrees when Chapman entered the game in the ninth inning. He got a quick out, then walked Sal Frelick on four pitches before Blake Perkins grounded in a double play. The 3-8 Sox can win their first series of the season on Wednesday afternoon with Sonny Gray on the mound against Shane Drohan, a former Red Sox minor leaguer who will be making his major league debut. "One step at a time," said Willier Abreu, who drew the five-pitch walk that ended Mizorowski's night in the sixth inning. Mizorowski threw the 49 fastest pitches in the game, something you don't usually see when a pitcher is opposing Crochet. But it was Crochet who pitched into the seventh inning and left with a lead. "We needed to stop the bleeding," Crochet said. "That's a really good kid on the other side. We made him throw strikes and we capitalized. But clearly, his stuff is incredible." When Crochet played at the University of Tennessee, coach Tony Vitello, who now manages the Giants, used to tell the pitchers that the team whose starter stays in the game the longest usually wins the game. "Just definitely trying to outlast Mizorowski," Crochet said. In his first career start against the Red Sox, Mizorowski struck out the first five batters he faced on 24 pitches. 18 of those pitches were triple-digit fastballs. The 24-year-old right-hander walked Sedan Rafaela, leading off the third inning, then got three outs on five pitches. Wilson Contreras broke up the no-hitter with a two-out single in the fourth inning, but Mizorowski came back to strike out Abreu, looking at a curveball. Crochet was not as dominant, but just as effective as he lined up zeros on the scoreboard. The left-hander stranded runners in scoring position in the second and third innings. Then he worked around some poor defense in the fourth inning. Gary Sanchez drew a walk with one out before Joey Ortiz grounded a ball up the middle toward shortstop Trevor Story. It looked like a double play had Story gone to the bag and fired to first, but his flip to second base didn't connect with Marcelo Mayer, and everybody was safe. Mayer was charged with an error for missing the catch. No matter, the Sox turned a conventional 6-4-3 double play on Luis Matos to end the inning. The door finally opened for the Sox with one out in the sixth inning when Mizorowski walked Jaron Duran, Contreras, and Abreu on 13 pitches. Story fell behind 0-2 against lefty D.L. Hall, then lined a double down the line in left to drive in two runs. Abreu got a good jump off third and scored when pinch hitter Caleb Durbin grounded slowly to second. "Sometimes you get that one opportunity and you have to capitalize," Story said. The 3-0 lead did not last long. Crochet loaded the bases with one out in the seventh as Joey Ortiz and Sal Frelick singled and Blake Perkins walked on a full count cutter. With Crochet at 106 pitches, it was pitching coach Andrew Bailey who went to the mound, not Cora. After a conversation, Crochet hit former teammate David Hamilton with his next pitch to force in a run. Zach Kelly emerged from the bullpen and got pinch hitter Christian Yelich to ground to third base. Durbin stumbled and the Sox were only able to get an out at second as a run scored. William Contreras grounded to shortstop to end the inning. Garrett Whitlock had a perfect eighth inning to set up Chapman. Chapman topped out at 96.8 miles per hour, well below his usual heat. Cora checked in with him and said the closer was fine. It apparently had more to do with it being 35 degrees. "It was cold," Chapman said. Pamela?
And now for a different type of entertainment. Fans take over Heinz Convention Center for Anime Boston 2026. Fans of Naruto, One Piece, and more took over the Heinz Convention Center this past weekend for Anime Boston 2026. The event, held April 3rd through 5th, returns for its 22nd installment, bringing artists, vendors, and fans from around New England and beyond together to celebrate the world of Japanese animation. Boston is a central place for a lot of different types of communities to get together, Omega Au, the convention's chair, told the Globe on Friday. several musical performers like composer Yoko Kanno and singer Coda, plus voice acting stars from hit anime shows shipped up to Boston for this year's convention, taking part in events like concerts, panels, as well as fans' meet and greets. The festivities also included pop-up manga shops, on-site tattoo parlors, gaming areas, and costume competitions. Andrew Davis, a board member for the New England Anime Society, teared up while praising Anime Boston for serving as a welcome event for all kinds of fans. "We get a lot of people that are like, I finally feel like I'm home. And that's what the key is," said Davis. According to Davis, the NEAS is always searching for ways to drive more diverse crowds, including running surveys to gauge what kind of events fans want the most. "We come here to find people who are like-minded, who love what they do and want to talk and engage with everyone," Davis said. "We're trying to keep the experience unique for our attendees." Kara?
Thanks, Pamela. And now taking a look at today's food pages. This is an article written by Deborah First of the Globe staff. "I never liked Dunkin', but now it feels like home. Thanks, RFK Jr. Can I get a large regular with extra Boston pride? For 30 years, I have lived in Boston. And for 30 years, I have remained baffled by one thing. Oh, no, not the rotaries. Those make sense. Not the lack of happy hour. Not the unwritten rules of snowstorm space saving. It's the coffee, specifically Dunkin'. Why does Boston run on coffee that doesn't taste like coffee? Dunkin's tastes like burnt sweet potatoes. And yet, the franchise is so much a part of our local fabric that when Cardi B played TD Garden last week, she addressed the crowd. Boston, you Dunkin' Donuts eating, word that definitely cannot be used here, how we doing tonight? I'm sure Ben Affleck was dancing somewhere in the crowd wearing a Red Sox jersey. I grew up in New York, believing that if the Yankees suck, it is only in occasional relation to the Mets, and totally unaware of Dunkin's regional chokehold just a few hours north. Dunkin' has a strong presence in my home state, but in Massachusetts, it has main character energy. When I moved here, I discovered that this chain appeared to be a religion. A cult? Would that be overstating things? After all around me, people were chugging iced coffee in the dead of winter, often while wearing shorts. And, quote, regular coffee came with cream and sugar by default. I had chosen a new home where light and sweet were the palate's preference, and I had to put my dark and caustic expectations on a shelf. I understand Dunkin' was founded here in Quincy in 1950. That's history and local pride. But Starbucks got its start in Seattle in 1971. You don't see Bill Gates appearing in its ads. The general populace doesn't call it Starbies. Last year, in fact, the Seattle Times ran a story with the headline, "Starbucks popularity has waned the most in hometown Seattle." After I had lived in Boston for about a decade, I had a eureka moment. Bostonians don't like coffee. Bostonians like caffeine, a bargain, and a beverage, well, that tastes like dessert. With this thought came acceptance, and after that, I mostly ignored Dunkin' discourse until last month. Then, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. called out Dunkin' for being unhealthy. "We're going to ask Dunkin' Donuts and Starbucks, show us the safety data that show that it's okay for a teenage girl to drink an iced coffee with 150 grams of sugar in it," he said. "I don't think they're going to be able to do it." Never mind that the average consumer of such a beverage in Boston is a burly middle-aged construction worker. Never mind that I've yet to see compelling safety data showing it's okay for a teenage girl to contract measles after foregoing vaccination. There are only a few drinks on Dunkin's lengthy menu with at least 115 grams of sugar, according to its easily accessed nutrition guide, mostly large frozen coffees that max out at 172 grams, a gobsmacking amount of sugar that would turn me into a gerbil on a wheel if I consumed it one sitting, though I'd probably pass out from brain freeze first. Each time RFK Jr. brings up the unhealthiness of the American diet, a "see, You can't dismiss the guy. He's right about some things. Think piece gets its wings. And each time I read one of these, I lose my schnitzel, fried in tallow, of course. We already know nutrition policy needs reform, and I can't think of another figure who has gotten so many plaudits for stating the obvious about public health while taking so many measures that could endanger it. So I felt a bit salty about this attack on sugar. And Boston felt very salty about this attack on Dunkin'. When Bostonians act extra Bostony-y, I often admire the spirit without fully sharing the viewpoint. Not this time. This time I was in perfect agreement. And then I saw it. On Instagram, Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey had posted an image inspired by a flag from the early days of the Texas Revolution. In place of a cannon, Healey's post featured a Dunkin' cup, but the words remain the same. Come and take it. No confiscation without representation. You can pry our iced coffee out of our cold, dead hands. I felt a surge of pride. Boston pride. I want to live in a city and state where politicians stand up for what is ours, be it a drink so sugary no mere mortal can withstand it, or legal rights that pertain regardless of immigration status, or trans kids' ability to determine who they are and live accordingly. And I felt the perverse urge to transgress. I walked to the closest Dunkin', all of 3 minutes away. I needed all the steps I could get if I was going to drink a vanilla bean culotta, the sugariest drink on the roster that I could contemplate actually consuming. A large clocks in at 167 grams of total sugar, 150 of them added, which is, in a more rational moment, I believe, is an anti-consumer hate crime. That suddenly seemed beside the point. I placed my order. The culotta was just the start. I also experienced, for the first time, the thrill of ordering an iced coffee extra extra. For a small, this turns out to include 4 sugars and 4 creams. And, in a nod to moderation, I added a small regular. I took a sip of the culotta, a slush as white as the driven snow. I had ignorantly assumed there would be coffee in there somewhere, but no. I took another sip, and another. An icy dagger pierced my head. My heart rate skyrocketed. But worst of all, I had to taste the stuff. Ugh, nothing should ever, ever be this sweet. The iced coffee, by comparison, was drinkable. Until my straw touched down in the drift of crunchy sugar strewn on the, over the cup floor. Extra, extra is too extra for me. Then I sipped my small regular. It was still way too sweet. It was also way too creamy. And it still tasted like burned sweet potatoes. It was perfect. I loved it. It tasted like home. Pamela
Duncan. And here are some of the today's talking points. Artificial intelligence. Anthropic claims new AI model Mythos is cybersecurity reckoning. Anthropic has built a new AI model that it claims is too powerful to be released to the public. Instead, Anthropic said Tuesday, it will make the new model, known as Claude Mythos Preview, available to a consortium of more than 40 technology companies, including Apple, Amazon, and Microsoft, which will use it to find and patch security vulnerabilities in software programs. Anthropic said it had no plans to release its new tech more widely, but was announcing the new model's capabilities in one area in particular, identifying security vulnerabilities in software, in an effort to sound the alarm over what it believes will be a new, scarier area of AI threats. The goal is both to raise awareness and to give good actors a head start on the process of securing open source and private infrastructure and code, said Jaron Kaplan, Anthropic's chief science officer. The coalition, known as Project Glasswing, will include some of Anthropic's competitors in AI, such as Google, as well as hardware providers like Cisco and Broadcom, and organizations that maintain critical open-source software, such as Linux Foundation. Anthropic is committing up to $100 million in cloud usage credits to the effort. Logan Graham, the head of Anthropic team that tests new models for dangerous capabilities, called the new model the starting point for what we think will be an industry-changing point or reckoning with what needs to happen now. Healthcare. Health insurers pare back some prior approval requirements. U.S. health insurers have made it easier for doctors to get approval before providing certain types of treatment. Industry groups said, calling a sign of progress towards alleviating burdensome delays for patients. Major health plans said they collectively removed thousands of prior authorization requirements for medical procedures since they pledged to cut red tape last year. About 11% of the approvals they mandated in 2024 are no longer in place, according to data from two leading insurance trade associations. That would mean about 6.5 million fewer requests in Medicare and some commercial plans, holding everything else constant, the group said. The data doesn't cover prior approvals for prescription drugs. Health insurers have long faced calls to fix the prior approval process in which insurers must greenlight doctors' orders before patients get treatment. Almost half of insured adults said it leads to a delay, denial, or different treatment than what was prescribed, according to a survey from health researcher KFF. More than a quarter of doctors in the American Medical Association survey said prior authorization led to hospitalization or other harm. Health plans are making progress on speeding up patient access to appropriate care while maintaining important protections against waste, fraud, and abuse, according to an announcement to be published Tuesday by the industry groups AHIP and the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association. Major insurers, including United Health Group Incorporated, Elevance Health Incorporated, Cigna Group, CVS Health Corporation, and Centene Corporation, made voluntary commitments to improve the process under pressure from the Trump administration. Apple Tech. Apple's foldable iPhone remains on track for September debut. Apple Incorporated's first foldable phone is on track to arrive during the company's normal iPhone launch period later this year, people with knowledge of the matter said, rebutting concerns about major manufacturing snags. The company is scheduled to introduce the foldable model in September alongside the iPhone 18 Pro and Pro Max, said the people, who asked not to be identified because the plans haven't been yet announced. Apple's phones typically hit store shelves this week after they unveiled. A report from Nikkei Asia had fueled concerns about a delay on Tuesday. Apple's shares fell as much as 5.1% after the news outlet said the company was facing challenges in the engineering test phase of the phone. That threatens to push back the production and shipment schedule, according to Nikkei Asia. While the complexity of the new display and materials may limit initial supply for several weeks, Apple is currently operating with a plan to put the device on sale around the same time, or very soon after, the new non-foldable models, the people said. Apple shares pared their losses after Bloomberg News reported the plans. Still, the release is 6 months away and the production has yet to ramp up. That means the timing isn't final. A spokesperson for a Cupertino, California-based company, declined to comment. And on pharmaceutical, Novo Nordisk will price its new high-dose Wegovy shot at $399 a month for cash-pay patients, undercutting the cost of most doses of rival Eli Lilly and Company's Zepbound. High-dose Wegovy will be available starting on Tuesday, Novo said. The price is about 40% less than what Lilly charges cash-pay patients for the top three doses of Zepbound. The stronger drug is an important part of Novo's efforts to catch up with Lilly, after a trial showed that Zepbound outperformed the standard dose of Wegovy. The prospect of more weight loss has helped the Lilly drug become the most popular obesity shot in the U.S. Karen?
Thanks, Pamela. And also from today's business section, this next article is from the Associated Press. Delta raising checked bag fees follows other major airlines as jet fuel costs rise. Delta Airlines announced Tuesday it is raising checked bag fees, part of a broader wave of U.S. carriers responding to higher jet fuel prices tied to the war in the Middle East. Beginning Wednesday, most passengers on domestic and short-haul international routes will pay $10 more for their first and second checked bags and $50 more to check a third. That brings the fees to $45 for the first bag, $55 for the second, and $200 for the third, according to Delta. These updates are part of Delta's ongoing review of pricing across its business and reflect the impact of evolving global conditions and industry dynamics, the carrier said in a statement. And that's all the time we have left for today's reading of the Boston Globe. This is Karen.
And Pamela.
Thanking every one of you for joining us today and asking you to please stay tuned for today's reading of the Boston Herald.